When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor of the New Books Network. NBN listeners like to read books and buy them. So we thought we'd tell you that right now, our friends at Princeton University Press are having a remarkable site-wide sale. You can get 50% off books, including ebooks and audiobooks, with the code 50, F-I-F-T-Y, at checkout until May 31. You can save some real money on Princeton University Press books. I encourage you to go there and check it out. Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to a new episode of the New Books Network podcast. My name is Khadija Ameda, and I'll be your host for the day. I'm here to interview Professor Radha Kapuria on her 2023 monograph, Music in Colonial Punjab, Courtesans, Bards, and Connoisseurs, 1800 to 1947. She is an assistant professor of South Asian History in the Department of History at Durham University, United Kingdom. Music in Colonial Punjab is the first social history of musical life in undivided Punjab. The book unearths new evidence for the centrality of female performers and classical music in a region primarily viewed as a folk music center. It features a range of musicians and dancers from Mirasis, Bards and Kalavans, elite musicians, to Kanjris, subaltern female performers, and Tawifs, courtesans. The work also sheds light on the impact of colonialism on the cultural politics of performance in Punjab. Without further delay, let me welcome Dr. Radha Kapuria on board. Thank you, Radha, for joining me today. Congratulations on your monograph. As you write in the preface, Music in Colonial Punjab is a memoir of songs and music you have inherited from your past, a past that had to go through historical events like the Great Partition, shaping the modern nation-states of India and Pakistan. How would you like to introduce this text to our listeners? And how have your experiences of being a third-generation child of Partition influenced your writing?
Thank you for having me here. I'm very delighted to be able to talk about my book with you on this podcast. I think I would like to introduce this book simply by saying that it offers us a window into the social history of music and dance in colonial Punjab, or to be even more precise, in the worlds of 19th century and early 20th century Punjab. So very much the experience of partition, which my grandparents went through and which was then transmitted to my parents and then down to me, is something that shaped the motivation for the book. So which is why it is entirely looking at the period which is before partition, and the century or so before partition in Punjab, and tries to reveal what kind of musicians and dancers were, you know, populating the cities of Punjab. What was the role of the folk practitioners of music in rural areas like the Mirasis, but also, of course, the connections between the two, between the Mirasis and the rural folk singers and those in urban courtly spaces. And then how did the transition to colonialism impact music making and practices of listening?
Thank you for that introduction. One of the central themes is the enduring stereotype of Punjab, created by colonial folklorists as a rural region with its folk music and dance. In your work, you move beyond the stereotype, reviving the classical musical heritage of the Punjab region, particularly through Hindustani music. What prompted you to initiate and consider classical music as an anchoring remark of the project?
Yes, I think the term I prefer to use in the book is, I sometimes refer to it as Hindustani classical music, but I prefer to use rag dadi music, essentially to avoid this problem of saying Hindustani music, because often practitioners in Pakistan would probably feel a bit uncomfortable calling it Hindustani music. So I think rag dadi music captures the essence of what it is to be classical music. I think rag dadi works for me because in my book, I break the stereotype of Punjab as a folk music center by drawing attention to its sort of neglected or disregarded lineages of classical music. But I don't do an either or binary. I don't say that there was no folk music or that classical music was more important than folk music. No, that is not my intention. In fact, as we know, there is a spectrum between folk and classical. Musicians like the Mirassis in particular, who are seen as repositories of folk music, are often trained in the basics and in the kind of the fundamentals of rag or classical music. So this is why I've, offered the term rag dadi music, which is basically rag-based music. Any kind of knowledge of rag or grounding in rag is essentially what, or even knowledge of rag is what constitutes classical music. Now, the stereotype of Punjab as folk center can be seen to lie for the first step within the post-1947 kind of structuring of the different regions of India into a sort of linguistic cultural stereotype. So Punjab became visualized in this national vision as the land of folk music and dance. But the roots of this imagination lie in the colonial period, as I show in chapter 2 of my book, that there was an army of colonial scholar administrators who were very interested in folklore. So colonial folklorists who went around Punjab collecting the folk tales of the region from the Mirassis. And so in doing that, in that passion for recording folklore, which was a very new thing, it was new even for Europe at that time in the late 19th century. Some of the same people who are collecting folk songs in Europe are then kind of posted to Punjab as part of colonial governance. And so they are also interested in collecting the folklore of Punjab. However, there is a sort of disrespect towards the musicians and the bards who tell these folk tales, who narrate these stories. So in other words, it is a very much a colonial enterprise where they're only interested in the folk knowledge and the folk tales and not so much in the people who are telling those stories. And I think the reason why the image of rural and folk Punjab or bucolic Punjab became so important at this time was also because the British wanted to reimagine Punjab, as the historian Navio Gill argues. They were literally trying to refashion Punjab from a land of swords, which is the military Sikhs who they defeated in the Anglo-Sikh wars, to the land of plowshares. So from swords to plowshares, and this image of the Jat rural Punjabi peasant, in other words, has its roots very much in the colonial period. We should also remember that the colonial state was very much involved in investing in agricultural infrastructure. So parts of Punjab which were not agricultural were in fact forested or desert, were slowly brought under an agrarian fold through the canal colonies, especially in West Punjab. So this is very much part of the colonial enterprise. And so this image of Punjab as rural and folklore lies in the colonial period, and then it gets adopted and becomes amplified after 1947, especially because partition has ruptured this memory of the classical lineages of performance of music in Punjab. So with the disruption of partition, this memory of Punjab as land of ragdari and urban classical music veins, and you only have, especially in Indian Punjab, you have the image of the folk music in Punjab, and in Pakistan, it's more of Qawwali music, but also folk.
Thank you for the response. This is a question I have always wanted to ask a music historian. So unlike an ethnomusicologist, a music historian lacks the privilege of directly accessing sounds from the past in its actuality. The strength of your book is the wide variety of archival resources. Some of your sources are on architecture, ragamala paintings, photographs, newspaper reports, and colonial travel writings. These sources are also multilingual. Can you explain your archival sources and experience of navigating them?
Yes. In fact, that is perhaps one of the weaknesses of the book, is that it doesn't rely as strongly on oral history, doesn't rely as strongly on ethnography, but it's entirely interested in recording a history of music between the period 1800 to 1947. And I consciously chose to not study the gramophone era in sort of this broad time frame, because there is a very rich sort of cache and archive of gramophone recordings from the 20s and 30s onwards. And that would require its own dedicated book. And I didn't want to just write roughshod over the sort of the early recordings we have. So it is very true that on the whole, especially for the period before recording, there is no way that I could know how the sounds and the music of colonial Punjab actually sounded. This problem is compounded by the fact that in South Asia, we have relatively a dearth of notation in learning music. With the reform movements of people like Pandit Vishnu Digambar Paluskar, who had a major influence on Punjab, we do start seeing some musical primers and books emerging in Punjab from the, say, the late 20s, 1930s, 1940s. But again, that is a fairly late or a fairly, you know, recent in comparatively in the historical time frame. If we want to think about what kind of music was being performed, how the sounds of the Darbar of Maharaja Ranjit Singh's court were, that becomes very difficult. And so I had to rely, obviously, on a range of different archival sources, from texts, so from the court chronicles produced at the Lahore court for Ranjit Singh's Darbar, or to the colonial archive, which was also quite rich, to you know, travelogues written by many European travelers to Punjab, to a lot of paintings. Now, not just ragamala paintings. And in fact, my book is not as keenly focused on musicological debates. So it doesn't go into looking at how different rags evolved or changed in Punjab, but it's looking more at a social history of the performers. So there are multiple paintings of musicians and dancers from this period. The company style of painting has taken over North India at this time. So there is many paintings of musicians and dancers from that school. But you have many anonymous paintings as well from Punjab, especially the Punjab plains, which were slightly different from the Punjab hills, or where this very strong Pahari school of painting existed. So there is, in other words, a range of visual material, visual archives on musicians and dancers. And it's important to rely on these archives apart from just the textual archives, because as I mentioned, there are multiple textual archives as well, But given that musicians and dancers are traditionally seen as being outside of proper conventional history or outside of the frame of history writing, it becomes important to, retrace their steps or write this history using multiple different kinds of sources. And so paintings become these important clues for us to follow some of these characters. And because in some ways, given the legacy of caste related to music across South Asia, but especially in Punjab, traditionally musicians and dancers have been bestowed with a lower caste and a derogatory social status. This makes their experience even more marginal and therefore not always very easy to access in the textual archives. So this was a very interesting process, and to kind of try and rewrite this, or sort of reconstruct this past, looking at these different kinds of sources, which were also multilingual, as you point out. Punjab at this time in the 19th and early 20th century was a melting pot for many different languages. While Punjabi was the spoken language, it was written in two scripts, Gurmukhi and Sharmukhi. You also had Urdu, which was very important. And you also had Hindi, which was increasingly adopted towards the late 19th and early 20th century by the Hindu minority of Punjab, which was the single largest minority in undivided Punjab. So all these different languages, apart from, of course, English, because that was the colonial archive, are needed to reconstruct histories of music in Punjab. I haven't mentioned Braj and Persian, but there are sources which are in these languages as well. But for reasons of expertise and time, I chose not to go in depth into the Persian and the Braj sources. But I think any future histories must take on these sources.
Wonderful to know about your archival journey. As you write the social and cultural history of Punjab, what fascinated me the most was how you brought in the ephemeral moments of the past, often overlooked in mainstream historical narratives. Through the lives of performers, patrons, listeners, and connoisseurs, you bring in nuances, including the gender dimensions of history. How would you like to detail this to our listeners?
Oh, that's a great question, especially about, how do you reconstruct the ephemeral moment of performance? I can share this, share the example of a manuscript from 1890s Patiala. Patiala and Kapurthala, the princely states, are the focus of my final chapter. And there was a very interesting manuscript which was illustrated, and it's present in the British Library. And it was something compiled for the princes, for the young princes of the Patiala royal family, to groom them and educate them in matters of religion, of culture, of theology, of ethics. And it was sort of a manual for princely training. And this text is called the Guru Nanak Prakash. And it has lavish paintings of, rulers from the Patiala house, royal house, and from of figures like Guru Nanak. But there is a very interesting section in that which talks about the power of music. And it is a whole section that is used to warn these princes who are reading. It's sort of a cautionary tale that you shouldn't become too embroiled in the pleasures of music and the senses. And so while it is a cautionary tale, the way in which it is narrated is going into great detail and depth about the intricacies of what music does to listeners. And so there are very telling phrases in this description of how the musicians were so skilled that they made the listeners, they became like statues on the wall, and the music was so powerful that all the different ragas and raginis were assembled. They embodied themselves and came and represented themselves in front of the listeners. So this, in a sense, this example which I have just narrated is also an ephemeral moment. It's something which someone who's writing a history of Patiala would overlook and say, oh, this is just, you know, some kind of model didactic tale. But my argument using this fragment was to say that in Patiala, even though there is a movement to the reform of music, and this is part of the moment of reform in Indian music at this time in the late 19th and 20th century, where there is a greater alignment with religious themes, where music is being brought into the public realm through the patina, through the respectable covering of religion and spirituality. But in Patiala, that older narrative of sensuality is not completely lost, because even in the moment of critique, the writer is showing us how much of a connoisseur he is of this more cosmopolitan, more secular stream of classical music, which was performed in all the courts. There are so many different examples of ephemeral moments. I would like to also bring out the example of one dancing girl whom I have given the name Karen, who we encountered through a newspaper report in the Times of India, again from the 1890s, but this time in Lahore. And she is basically a victim of an assault where her jewelry was robbed by highway robbers, and she was kind of violently assaulted. And so she takes this to court, bringing the culprits to justice. And for some reason, her story attracts huge audiences in Lahore, especially amongst the male patrons and listeners. And this becomes a moment of remark by the sort of British reporter of the Times of India at that time. And so I think it's interesting to see how, courtesans or dancing girls at this time were such powerful figures. This courtesan, Karen, she notes how she used to perform for the different courts from Jammu to Patiala to Kashmir. And she used to command huge fees for performance as well. So I think the gender dimension of performance of music in Punjab is very important. As my first chapter details, even though it is set, basically the first chapter is at the court of Maharaja Ranjit Singh, the real protagonists of that chapter are his courtesans and how powerful they were to symbolize the political might of the Sikh kingdom to European political rivals. The gender dimension is again important in the reform of music, which I just mentioned a moment ago, where with the emphasis on religious music, this became the rationale or the excuse through which middle-class, upper-caste women could be taught music and could be allowed to perform music in public, only if it was a sort of religious music, mainly to distance them from the lineage of the courtesans. And so both these movements on music, first is to abolish the institution of dancing and to kind of target the courtesans and dancing girls, who were very powerful, as we noted, at the court of Ranjit Singh. And then this is slowly changing with the reform movement. But equally, we also have white women as members of the colonial ruling elite or as female missionaries who are again itinerating in rural Punjab. And some of them, like Anne Wilson, who was the wife of James Wilson, who was a very important figure in the colonial state, she learns music from the Mirassis in rural Shahpur. Similarly, you have many female missionaries who are very eager to inculturate or to kind of carry on their mission work through Punjabi songs, and so to trans translate the message of the Christian hymns and the Christian biblical teaching into very Punjabi musical forms. So again, gender, I think, in all three cases, becomes a really key dimension to history of music in Punjab.
Thank you for sharing such exciting examples of ephemerality. Going ahead, a peek into the musical past lives of Mirasis, the region's generational musicians, is a significant contribution of the study. Despite possessing elite musical knowledge, they were often subjected to a culture of contempt. You also bring in a rare text like Mirasi Nama, written by Muhammaduddin, to explore the social reform enforced by the emerging middle classes on Mirasis. How difficult was the life of Mirasis, even if they were a part of the royal courts or higher social circles?
That's a really great question. The Mirasis are a very important group if one has to write a history of music in Punjab or generally in the Northwest and in other parts of North India as well. They are a hereditary caste of storytellers or bards, which is why the subtitle of my book is, Courtesans, Bards, and Connoisseurs. So they were bards, they were genealogists, and of course they were musicians. So they played a very important part in everyday life of most Punjabis, especially in rural contexts. As genealogists, they used to maintain the family trees going back multiple generations for the family of their patron, for the higher caste patron family they served. Given the kind of caste dynamic, they were considered to be lower caste and were therefore also very poor. So there was social and economic hardship. However, there was what I detail in the book is a fear of the Mirasis, which is noted by multiple commentators, whether in colonial Punjab or in post-colonial Punjab or even in the present. And this fear, this sort of, it's a colloquial fear. There are many proverbs which capture this sort of mistrust or fear of the Mirasi. And I argue this is because Mirasis held a lot of knowledge of their patrons' family histories, but also folk and cultural knowledge. In the evenings, at the end of a long day's work in the rural setting, the form of entertainment was to go and listen to the kissas and stories which the Mirasis would sing and narrate. And so the Mirasis had multiple levels of knowledge. As I mentioned, first is the personal family knowledge of the patron caste. The second is folk and cultural knowledge. And related to that, the third is musical knowledge. As we noted, the Mirasis were a repository of classical music as well. And there's multiple examples in the book where we note how the Mirasis are used by people who are eager to learn music in the colonial period to teach. The Mirasis are the ones who teach them the rudiments of rag music. And so they had these multiple levels of skills. And by rag music, I don't mean simply vocally sung rag music. Many of them were accompanists as well, especially to the courtesans and dancing girls. And so the Mirasis had all this knowledge gave the Miras the level of power, which was seen with great mistrust by the upper caste. So the Mirasi was also very well known in the arts of wit, repartee, satire, and quipping, and making riddles and jokes. So for all these reasons, the Mirasis, quickness of their tongue was something that was remarked upon by many people. And the Mirasi Nama, which is a text from 1891, written in a kissa format or a sort of folktale story format, which is a kissa is meant to be sung. It's meant to be recited. So it's written as in that form and written by a police constable called Muhammaduddin, who is basically it's basically a rant against the Mirasis, and it's filled with colorful expletives and colorful abuse terms heaped at the Mirasis. But at the same time, while the text is written in a very vernacular, colloquial, almost bawdy register of Punjabi, the script is that's used is the Persian or Urdu script. And the foreword and afterword to the kissa are written in Urdu, not in Punjabi. And in the foreword and the afterword, Muhammaduddin is keen to mention that not all Mirasis are bad, because most of his kissa is meant to kind of say, these are the ways in which the Mirasis are not to be trusted, or they are cheats and they are, you know, they're liars and they're cunning, or they are promiscuous. So he's saying in the foreword and afterword, in fact, not all Mirasis are like this. Some of them are indeed very pious and very educated. And so he says that his whole aim in writing this text is to reform the Mirasis by you know, showing them the path of being Muhammadi, or the path of Islam. And so he's saying, he keeps saying they are not good Muslims because they indulge in all these nefarious activities. Muhammaduddin also has a problem with the fact that the Mirasis service different communities. And at one point in the text, he says, aise hain ahmak madan, Hinduan naal Hindu banjan, Musalman vich Musalman, which essentially says that such are these innocent dolts that with Hindus they become Hindus, and amongst Muslims they are Muslims, which is essentially to say that the Mirasis knew the musical repertoires of different communities, and based on whoever they were serving, they could sing the sort of religious songs of that community. So at the time the Mirasinama is written, religious identities are slowly becoming more homogenized, more monolithic, and more separate from the other. And this is what Muhammaduddin is articulating by saying these Mirasis should be true to their religion. They should not follow the path of Satan. In fact, the refrain of the text is that certain Mirasis are like the sons of Satan. With every other thing, they narrate their argument. So they keep arguing. So his whole critique of the Mirasis is to do with their wit, with their social knowledge and cultural knowledge and folk knowledge. And he's attempting to reform them. Now, my argument is that unlike the upper caste reformers from cities like Lahore, Amritsar, Jalandhar, who are basically abusing Mirasis without really engaging with them, Muhammaduddin, who is writing in the provincial town of Gujranwala, which is close to Lahore, he is, even though he is ranting against the Mirasis, he's giving us very colorful and detailed examples of how, in his mind, the Mirasis are sinning. And he keeps trying to reform them, and he keeps saying, come join my profession, become a policeman, or come become a better Muslim. And, you know, and he keeps saying, forgive me if I have offended anybody. So that leads me to argue that actually Muhammaduddin had a level of social proximity with the Mirasis. He was able to converse with them in the format that the Mirasis themselves use, which is the kissa. So it's a colloquial text, and it's a really rich archival text, which helps us piece together the lives of Mirasis at this time. And what is curious is, why has it survived? And it is present in the British Library in London. And this takes us to the larger context in which a text like this would have been preserved, which is to say that at this time, the colonial state was very eager, as we noted earlier, to collect folklore, and especially from the perspective of trying to understand what the culture of the people they governed was. And so from that perspective, they have collected a text like the Mirasinama. And Muhammaduddin is a police constable serving the colonial state, the colonial machinery. So he is also someone who's probably, as a policeman, he's also meant to police the movements of nomadic groups, the movements of groups who would be labeled criminal tribes, right? Not that the Mirasis were, but at the same time, they are a group who are viewed with suspicion, because if they have this kind of level of skill, and often there was this level of surveillance. So no wonder this text exists at this time and has, through the India Office records, reached the British Library.
Along with Mirazi's, the role of Christian missionaries is also crucial in shaping a musical colonial Punjab. It was interesting how they had to adapt to the region by engaging with the musical traditions such as bhajans that eventually ended up with the formation of Punjabi Christian bhajans. Additionally, the vernacular language politics introduced by Christian missionaries, such as favoring Urdu over Punjabi as the church language, especially among the anglicized middle class, raises interesting questions. What was the role of Christian missionaries' musical mission work in Punjab's history?
Thank you. That's a very important question, because there was some very important foundational work done by a figure called Reverend Imamuddin Shahbaz, who was called, quote, the most respectable of Indian Christians, who was from Sialkot, which is also close to Lahore. Now, he was kind of someone whom the missionaries collaborated with to produce Punjabi Zabur. Now, Zabur is the Arabic word for psalm, for the Christian psalm. And he was kind of, again, the same time as we have the Mirasi Nama being published. And let's not forget, the Mirasi Nama was available for purchase through the Gujranwala Mission High School. So the connection to mission work is clear even there with the Mirasis. This text by Shahbaz, Reverend Shahbaz, was called Zabur Punjabi Nazam Me Tarjuma Kiya Gaya, which was a collection of 55 Punjabi Psalms, published again in 1892. It was Punjabi Psalms, but written in Roman script and with musical notation in the Western staff notation. And the important thing is that these Psalms were set to rag and not to in any kind of biblical or Christian or Western system. And this is something that Shahbaz did. So he was the one who translated and wrote or kind of translated the Psalms into a Punjabi which could be sung and which could be popular. And he worked with the help of a local professional Hindu singer called Radha Kishan. And in this kind of collaborative work, there were also some female missionaries who were very important. As I mentioned earlier, the gendered aspect. So women like Henrietta Cowden, Mary Martin, etc., were very important in setting these zabur's to music, and so there is you know, they did a very careful kind of, as you can imagine, collaboration between the Indian system and the Western system, and it was done to such a successful degree that while, as you mentioned, Urdu was favored by church missionaries over Punjabi as the church language, very much like the colonial state favored Urdu over Punjabi at this time, even though this was the case for the preaching in the sermons of the church, the songs were mostly Punjabi. And this explains to us the anomaly of, in many parts of North India and Pakistan, even today, while the sermon might be in Urdu, there are many songs which are in Punjabi. And so even if you're not Punjabi and you're a Christian in North India or Pakistan, you might be singing Zabur in Punjabi. And so this is the kind of importance of Reverend I.B. Shahbaz in creating these Punjabi hymn books.
Thank you for the detailed response on Christian missionaries. And now I'm jumping into the 19th century. I have like three questions on 19th century's musical history. The first one is about the making of a modern public musical sphere in places like Lahore, Amritsar, and Jalandhar. The musical public included the entry of women from upper caste and upper class backgrounds, sidelining the hereditary musicians and dancers. Can you share on this musical public? And do you think contemporary contributions, such as those by the Nooran sisters, have the potential for a revival of hereditary musicians?
Wonderful question. I think I already mentioned how women from upper class, middle class background started entering the public sphere of music in cities like Lahore, Amritsar, Jalandhar. Mainly thanks to the efforts of Pandit Vishu Digambar Paluskar, who was, as we know, from the region, the West Indian region of Maharashtra. But he found his first successes as a pedagogue, as someone who taught Hindustani music to members of these upper caste and middle class backgrounds, to people who were from non-hereditary backgrounds, basically teaching music to those who were from non-musician families, which was a sort of sidelining of the hereditary musicians and dancers. However, it was done more to kind of modernize music in the light of the encounter with colonialism. And what Paluskar did was he framed it within a language of Hindu devotionalism. And it is for this reason that he found his first successes in Punjab, because as I mentioned earlier, Punjab had a very large population of Hindus who were the largest minority in undivided Punjab. And the reform organizations of the Hindus, like the Arya Samaj and the Sanatan Dharm Sabha, the Sanatan Dharm Sabha is the one who invited Paluskar to Lahore in the first place. And he went on to then stay in Lahore for many years and set up the first Gandhar Mahavidyalaya in the city of Lahore. And from there, he kind of exported his successes to Bombay, where currently the biggest GMB still stands. And so as part of this movement to educate the kind of anglicized public, and he, of course, on paper, it was open to members of all religions, but there was an emphasis on Hindu bhajan and more kind of pious songs, from the Vedic times, etc. And this attracted a very certain typically clientele, which included people who were affiliated to the reform, Hindu reform movement. You have people like Devki Sood, who becomes the first Punjabi woman to write about music, to write a primer on music called Sangeet Prabha. And she is writing in Amritsar in 1934. And to my understanding, she's probably the first woman, certainly in the 19th and 20th centuries, to be writing about music, the first Punjabi woman. She is in her book constantly being derogatory to Mirasis and courtesans, Supta wife and Kanjri. And it is only by vilifying women from performing communities that these middle class women think or feel that they're able to perform in public by saying we are performing music because it is Devvidya, or it is a knowledge of the gods. And at the same time, you also have this movement to reform the very lusty folk songs of women in Punjab, including the Sichniya, which are sung at weddings. So these are reformed or rewritten, where the melody is retained, very much in some ways a kind of version of what we just discussed with the Punjabi Zabur of Shahbaz, where he's using pre-existing folk tunes and rag to set to music these new Punjabi Zabur. Here you have older sitnis and songs where the words are changed so that the older connections to sensuality or sexuality are muted, and instead the words are replaced with things like God and Prabhu and service and, education. So it's very much a part of this movement for social religious reform, which we are seeing at this time. The latter half of your question is that whether contemporary contributions by those like the Noora sisters, if those contributions can perhaps revive hereditary musicians. I certainly think the Rona sisters have done a lot to bring attention to the very rich tradition they have inherited from their grandmother. Even there, there is a reticence to always say that we come from a Mirasi family. Originally, the Rona sisters were very proud of their Mirasi heritage, at least based on their website. Going back a few years, like 5 years ago, their website has changed. And instead of saying that they hail from a Mirasi background and are also trained in a classical lineage, which is the Sham Chaurasi lineage, they now only say that we are trained in the classical Sham Chaurasi lineage and they are Sufi singers. So they've rebranded themselves in terms of being Sufi singers, which perhaps has a more palatable appeal, a more global and more respectable connotation than Mirasi. So still the term Mirasi, unfortunately, is still seen with that negative connotation, which is very much a legacy of this 19th century wave of social reform. But of course, that 19th century wave built on earlier traditions and a more deep-rooted kind of negativity towards the Mirasi community, which I've already mentioned.
That's an interesting response. Next question, I think, is almost like a continuation of the previous response. In the 19th century, a modern sensibility to musical pedagogy was introduced, as in the case of KMV Orchestra. This modern sensibility brought about changes such as the censorship of musical lyrics, the introduction of new musical instruments, and the emergence of caste and class relations in music learning. How interconnected were music and modernity during this period?
Yes, thanks for mentioning the Kanya Mahavidyalaya Orchestra, which emerged in the early 20th century. But the Kanya Mahavidyalaya in the city of Jalandhar is one of the oldest all-girls school, which was set up by the Arya Samaj, which was a very powerful Hindu reform organization, which started again in West India in Gujarat with Dayanand Saraswati. But again, very much in the way Paluskar was later adopted by the Hindus in Punjab, Arya Samaj became very widely patronized by the sort of anglicized, educated Hindus of Punjab who were servicing the colonial state and very keen to modernize and reform their religion. So the Arya Samaj had some positive aspects to it in terms of it cut down on excessive ritualism. It was against caste. It was, it had these very positive aspects, and it was against idol worship. It was more about community prayer and singing together and things like that. And of course, the slogan was back to the Vedas. But, with the emphasis on music and collective singing, very much in a sense as a response to the congregational singing brought by the Christian missionaries, the Arya Samaj missionaries were also articulating their agenda in competition with the Christian missionaries, and in some ways to counter the proselytization of the Christian missionaries. And so in this attempt, they started, of course, writing bhajans, and there's lots of song booklets of the Arya Samajis. And the strange thing is that at one of the earliest meetings in Lahore in the 1870s, the singers at one of these Arya Samaj gatherings were Muslim. And this is remarked upon by the English commentator who is present and is visiting and is attending. And he says, "Oh, I was quite shocked to see that these Mohammedan musicians are singing." And again, later, at a few years later, again, you hear there's a similar group of Muslim musicians and three Muslim musicians. And my sense is that these musicians would have to be Mirasis, because at this time, the group of social group that has the skill to sing and to perform on instruments and vocally also perform music were the Mirasis. So in the earliest days of the Arya Samaj in Punjab, the Mirasis were crucial to launching the singing and community singing. But people in the KMB later who wrote books again to educate girls in music, it all is, and all this literature produced by the Arya Samaj a bit later, there is a lot of vilification of the Mirasis. But it's interesting to see that at some of their earliest meetings, these Mirasis were the ones whom they relied on for music. And so I think even though there is an attempt to become modern through opening up music to middle class, upper caste women who would otherwise be removed from music, it's always one group is sort of winning and the other is losing out. So the modernity comes for one group and is stripping away on the rights and the and to the relative social respect which was enjoyed by groups like the courtesans and female performers earlier. And of course, also the vilification of the Mirasi. Now, obviously, we are not going to claim that the Mirasi has had it all great in the period before colonialism. But certainly with colonialism, with this is something that, you know, scholars of caste in South Asia have already established and argued, that what was earlier social became institutional. And so the colonial legislation and policies were oriented to dispossess lower caste groups even more than perhaps they were earlier. And so, you know, and the municipal elections of Lahore in 1890, all the lower caste groups were not allowed to stand for these municipal elections. Of course, you could only be a man and own property of a certain value, which would automatically debar anyone who wouldn't, and most of the kind of lower caste groups. However, by noting the names of these caste groups and saying anyone from these castes is not allowed, which included the Mirasis, it shows you how there was this further distancing between upper caste and the Mirasis.
The third theme I wanted to discuss is the changing pious question associated with music in the 19th century. The making of pious music gradually led to the exclusion of female performers from sacred spaces like Sufi dargahs or shrines. Could you elaborate on how the construction of musical piety varied across different religions during this time?
Very important question. It's a very good connection you have picked up on when you say that the making of pious music led to the exclusion, gradual exclusion of female performers from public spaces. I think I have perhaps mentioned the Hindu case in fairly good detail. I can refer to the Sikhs and the Muslims, and I've also discussed the Christian example. I think in the case of the Sikhs, again, there was, there was this emphasis on the male musicians far more than on female musicians. We do hear of some figures who were Sikh, Kirtan and Rababi, especially Sikh vocalists, female vocalists who would sing. For example, Mata Jeevan Kaur of Kapurthala, who would perform Kirtan in the late 19th century. But it's only in the 1930s that we really find some more examples of women performing Sikh Kirtan. And this has been studied by scholars like Balbir Singh Kamal, who has written in Punjabi, and Gurminder Bhogal, who has written in English. So they were a bit late as compared to the Hindu drive for social reform, where music was seen as key to reimagining Hindu piety in the case of the Arya Samaj and even the Sanatan Dharma, where practices like community singing and bhajans were being brought in. In that context, Hindu women were being encouraged to learn music for pious reasons. This was a bit slower in the case of the Sikhs. In the case of the Muslims, there was a very interesting story about as late as 1939, we had a very common or very popular prevalence of courtesans and female performers singing and dancing in Sufi shrines. And in some parts of India, and perhaps in Pakistan, I'm not sure, this might have continued even as late as the, say, the 70s, 80s or 90s in the 20th century. But in 1939, I found a very curious bill in the National Archives of India, which was called the Music at Muslim Shrines Bill or the Female Singers Prohibition Bill. And this was tabled in the Punjab Legislative Assembly, and it essentially sought to outlaw any female performers from Sufi shrines. Now, the debates were very interesting to see how many figures, most of the people said that this is, it brings a bad name to a, to these very pious saints of the Sufi tradition. And it's something which is very un-Islamic and very irreligious to have these women sing and dance. Others argued and said, why are the women being targeted alone? If you have a problem with singing and dancing, all performers, including male, should be stopped from doing so at Sufi shrines. The other debate was that what is the radius around which, around the shrine, that you can have female dancers and singers perform? And they said it should be a 3 mile, 5 mile. But then others pointed out that there would be people living in their homes, especially non-Muslims, or even perhaps Muslims, who would on occasions like births and marriages want to invite these women to sing and dance. So it would be unfair to prohibit such performance in the space of the home, in the private space. However, in a public sacred space like the Sufi Dargah or shrine, such music was increasingly seen as a problem, especially by these women. And there was a fine which was imposed on any women performing. So it slowly just meant the death of such practices. And it wasn't just the Sufi shrines. We have examples of courtesans and dancing girls singing and going to shrines like the Gulab Dasi Dera of the, which is a Sikh sect, and many other sort of popular Hindu shrines as well. And so I think this connection between sacred and sensual was very important in the places like Punjab. And this is something we have forgotten. For South India, of course, we have the history of Devadasi and temple dedication of dancing girls. So the connection to religion is pretty clear. But even across North India, you have these stories. And I think more research needs to be done on female performers in sacred spaces like these.
This is really intriguing. So I would like to conclude our interview with a question that is relevant to the current political context of India. The text discusses the politics of female voice, particularly with the rise of Hindu nationalism. However, alongside these nationalist female voices, there also existed sensual voices. Could you elaborate on the historical coexistence of these different musical expressions?
Wonderful question. I think the coexistence of, the sort of nationalist, pious female voice with a more sensual tradition was, I think if we were to say what happened over time was that the pious nationalist female voice became louder and more amplified and drowned the older tradition of the sensual voice. Again, instead of just simply offering a binary between pious and sensual, I think, as the example of the dancing girls in religious and in sacred spaces reveals, there was, the spiritual and the sensual were very deeply connected. Example being one of the most popular and most beloved Muslim courtesan wives of Maharaja Ranjit Singh. He married two Muslim courtesan wives and had to face great opposition from the Sikh orthodoxy for doing so. The first one, the most famous one, was Bibi Mora, so named because she could dance like a Moor or a peacock. Now, Bibi Mohra, you know, of course, after she married him, she continued being a Muslim, and she, as the wife of a king, she patronized very important places like madrasas, and she built a mosque which is called Maimora Mosque in Lahore. She also donated to the Bhadrakali Temple. She also built temples. So she was a figure who was very much interested in religion and the spirituality, and in the spiritual, and the spiritual sort of welfare of her subjects, while being a former dancing girl and while embodying a sensual voice, right? And so I think that story and that history has been forgotten, and I don't know how much or for how long really these two coexisted. They coexisted in the late 19th and in the early 20th century. By the mid to late 20th century, the tradition of only sensual voice was sort of, you know, of only courtesans was slowly dying, I think. And, you know, the difference between the elite courtesan and the sort of common dancing girl or the kanjari was slowly being erased. And this is evident in how the you know, the bridge of the dancing girl, which is what Maharaja Ranjit Singh built for Bibi Mohra, in the Persian chronicles, which I've read in translation, in those chronicles, this site was called the wife pool, or pul mohra, which means the wife is courtesan and pul is a bridge. But in the popular memory today, it is referred to as pul kanjari, where the term kanjari is, you know, seen as being a term that encompasses all these public female performers. So I think there is a lack of understanding of how there were gradations amongst the female performers as well. And over time, people have forgotten this history of powerful female performers in a region like Punjab.
Thank you, Dr. Radha Kapuria, for joining the New Books Network. I'll be back with another new book. Stay tuned.